visit to the library, invite you to pick up one of these little yellow pamphlets, carry it around with you all next week and the week after that, so that you may become more familiar with what takes place here and the policy of this lodge. It's our custom to read the Declaration of the United Lodge of Theosophists so that you may get a synopsis of the policy of this lodge, which is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy, without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim and purpose and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers. The sole bond between its associates being that basis, and it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization, and it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes, and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. As stated in our declaration, we meet to spread, broadcast the teachings of theosophy as recorded in the writings of H.P. Blavatsky and William Q. Judge. And for that purpose, as you can plainly see, we're here this morning, which is Sunday. And every Sunday morning, the doors open at 10:30 and the meeting begins promptly at 11. This is April, or the last of April. The topic this morning, the 17th, will be three kinds of genius. Next week, creative imagination and will. And as we stated, if you pick up one of these, we have the next quarter coming up, April, May, and June is printed on this. We pause to remind you, though, that on Sunday, May the 6th, there will be a special meeting called White Lotus Day to honor H.P. Blavatsky and Theosophy. Now, weekly meetings begin promptly at 7:30 and are over at 8:30. The doors open at 5:15 so that you may come into the library. It's a theosophical reference library and you'll find all the literature there for free use. Library closes at 7:15, meeting begins promptly at 7:30. We covered just about everything, but as I said, this is a valuable little pamphlet because printed on the front are some things that you perhaps never even thought of. As is our custom, this morning we're going to have a reading on the topic, and the ULT talk this morning is three kinds of genius. Learn from me in brief. And what manner the man who has reached perfection attains to the Supreme Spirit, which is the end, the aim, and the highest condition of spiritual knowledge. Imbued with pure discrimination, restraining himself with resolution, having rejected the charms and sounds of other objects of the senses, and casting off detachment and dislike, dwelling in secluded places, eating little, with speech, body, and mind controlled, engaging in constant meditation and unwaveringly fixed in dispassion, abandoning egotism, arrogance, and violence, and vanity, desire, anger, pride, possession, with calmness, ever present. A man is fitted to be the Supreme Being, and having thus attained to the Supreme, he is serene, sorrowing no more, no more desiring, but a light towards all creatures. He attains the supreme devotion to me, Krishna. By this devotion to me, he knoweth fundamentally who and what I am, and having thus discovered me, he enters into me without any intermediate condition. And even the man who is always engaged in action shall attain by my favor to the eternal and incorruptible, imperishable abode, if he puts his trust in me alone. With thy heart, place all thy works on me, prefer me to all else, exercise mental devotion continually, and think constantly of me. There dwelleth in the heart of every creature, O Arjuna, the Master, Ishvara, who by his magic power causes all things and creatures to revolve, mounted upon the universal wheel of time. Take sanctuary with him alone, O son of Bharata. With all thy soul, by his grace thou shalt obtain supreme happiness, the eternal place. Thank you.
Thank you. Those wonderful words of Krishna to Arjuna are so inspiring and so well suited to upholding the mysteries of mind, our theme for this particular month. So this morning we've come to three kinds of genius. And we know as we look around popular culture here in the United States, there's a great fascination in the general population about genius. There are people that are talking about emotional quotient, the EQ, the IQ, the intelligent quotients. We're having an argument in the society about whether you should use standardized testing to measure a child's genius or whether you should be using a portfolio assessment. There are those that hold with Maslow's hierarchy of needs and how to get to a self-actualization of genius and use that in governmental policy. There's associations like Mensa where there's an elitism. But all of these conditions, including the neo-baby boom of the 80s, where there was this super baby parenting going on, all of those public expressions can be seen in a certain light by the student of theosophy, can't they? One, all of those popular searches and uprootings are all dependent on an underlying assumption that genius is, that genius is possible for many, if not all, and that there's this untapped potential somehow in the human state. Another underlying assumption that we see in that popular searching and celebration of the mystery of genius is the reliance of using the scientific method, cause and effect, to try to figure out why genius occurs and how can it be duplicated in child development in larger populations. And the final evidence of a common or a shared impress of assumptions is that whether people are progressive or conservative doesn't matter. There's a search to promote solutions for childhood development, an argument about which is more important, nurture the environment or nature, the way the child is born. Theosophy, as a philosophy, incorporates all of that In a straightforward stance on three kinds of genius. The first is that there is soul resident in the human kingdom, living through the brain, through the physical body, through all aspects of nature, and that soul reflected Ishwara in each of us is based on the notion of that first fundamental. In the Secret Doctrine, we can read, it is only through a vehicle of matter that consciousness wells up as I am I, a physical basis being necessary to focus a ray of the universal mind at a certain stage of complexity. So in reality, we are soul, eternal, a ray of the universal mind. And then the philosophy would also offer for our consideration that there are artificial, partial, and very true or pure expressions of genius among us, and that all those expressions, all those manifestations of which we become aware, are all governed by reincarnation and karma. Everything is governed by the law of periodicity. Spirit over matter, moving in cycles of periodicity. In the writings of William Q. Judge, we find an explanation for geniuses that can only be met by the notions of rebirth and reincarnation. And through his writings, through many of the articles in the philosophy, we're told that the flame of genius is not lit by an anthropomorphic god. There's no miracle. There's no random chance, if you will, but it's the very nature of the spiritual entity itself, that inner man, that true self that's incarnating, which weaves webs of cause and effect by motives and gradually determines what the expression of that ego can be. Working, soul working in an environment, soul working through a brain, a family, a body, etc., conditioned in a society, can either express the full potential within or express a little bit of it. Key, of course, would be karmically what's available to that soul to use in a particular incarnation. Now, the first of the types of genius are called artificial genius. And this is created by the soul seeking perfection, but in a personal, particularized, or self-centered kind of a way. And we all know what it takes to develop talent, and we can extend that for the artificial genius. Practice makes perfect. Practice and motive and desire and will focused in a particular way creates skandhas, tendencies, potentials that are available within, and then the conditions of life allow for the expression of that. And that first lowest level of artificial genius that we're probably most aware of is in the physical expressions of life. If you think of a tremendous athlete, a natural athlete who appears to have tremendous talent regardless of what the arena might be. Something as mundane as a typist who's capable of typing away furiously while looking around the room and holding a conversation with someone else. The physical body is expressing talent, genius in a particular way, but it is a focus that's been developed where soul has focused on the personal, the physical, and usually in a particular avenue. HPB wrote that born out of the chaos of terrestrial sensations, of perceptive and retentive faculties, yet of finite memory, it will ever remain the slave of its own body. It is easier for the personality with its acute physical senses and tattvas to gravitate toward the lower quaternary than to soar to its triad. And again, in the philosophy, there's a teaching that soul is in a sevenfold vehicle. The first three, the highest principles are eternal. The lower four, the quaternary, are transient. And in the artificial genius, especially in the physical scandic sense, that genius shows forth in a transitory way and then can retreat. There's another kind of artificial genius that might also be called partial genius. And again, it is based on lifetimes of will and desire and effort. But the difference is in a partial genius, there's a degree of creativity. There's a degree of imagination that is being used in that form of genius. Such genius can range from child prodigies, and right now it's very popular on TV in this country to watch precocious and child prodigies perform. But in these creative processes, we find the use of mind and the use of genius in a way that transcends the physical. There is a degree of abstraction, there's a degree of spirituality, if you will, or creativity, in the expression of this genius. So in this category, we might place artists, musicians, writers, philosophers, research scientists who are using a very abstract form of research. These are all fields in which the personal is used as an expression for what is interior, what is soul, and imagination or creativity is absolutely the key. And we learn through the philosophy in a number of different readings that imagination is a spiritual power. Our desires arise from imagination. We can envision something, but in the partial genius, the expression of that creativity is actually limited to a particular field usually. And there may be a circumstance, and there certainly was the case of Blind Tom, who was a youngster in the 1800s, who was a savant, a musical genius by nature, but in every other range physically, that poor soul had a really tough conditioned experience with blindness and limitation of intellectual capacities, etc. In this partial expression of genius, we might also choose to place someone like a Da Vinci or a Thomas Jefferson, where the creativity is beginning to be shown, soul powers beginning to be shown in a variety of fields, but it is not in full bloom, if you will. And therein lies the greatest evidence of all that this philosophy has to offer. If the potential is within, if it is soul or spiritual potential shared by one and all, potentially, therefore, the true genius is available to all of us across lives, using reincarnation and karma, self-evolving, any one of us can become a full genius or can become an assistant to a full genius. In this category, the philosophy would place the enlightened ones, the masters, the elder brothers, the Mahatmas, if you will, two of the prime examples of full genius that are frequently offered are Jesus the Christ and the Buddha, Gautama the Buddha. Again, when we see an expression of such rare and full and magnificent genius of soul literally encompassing all levels of experience in this incarnation, all substance planes and energy forms, if you will. The skandhas have been developed across time using will and desire for a particular purpose, and that is highly ethical, highly altruistic, really pure motivations, if you will. The conditions of life by karma create the right vehicles, the right environment for the expression of such a one. And the genius itself is based upon that value-added reality of altruism and a firm hold on the reality of universal brotherhood. Such a one is able to hold a focus and therefore control any aspect at any plane or any principle of reality. All of great nature would be totally under the control of that pure genius. In other words, the brain and the body used has been made porous, has been developed in such a way to allow soul wisdom of the one of the highest principles, the Buddhic principle, to be expressed from within, without. Blavatsky wrote that great genius, if true and innate, and not merely an abnormal expansion of our human intellect or the creation of physical prowess, can never be copied, never condescend to imitate, but will ever be original in its creative impulses and realizations. And from the point of view of the student, there's no random chance of a sempiternity or a specialized predestination of a deity or nothing that is controlled from without or created from without. She continued to say that the dynamic force alone that can move the world is divine compassion, with its twin, divine intelligence, and each of these evokes the other. In the Mahatma, it is the divine compassion and the divine intelligence in which the state of conscious genius is achieved and held eternally. So we have the example of the Mahatma, a personage who, by special training and education, has self-evolved the higher faculties, attained spiritual knowledge, and ordinary humanity passes through a series of reincarnations, provided with the opportunity to follow the path shown, to very gradually self-evolve the highest and purest form of spirituality imaginable. And what are we to do where we are right now in our incarnations? If our intuition is that the philosophy is correct, if our reasoned faith and imagination allows for the fact that this is a possibility, that we could all have the hope of serving in the tradition of the Kuan Yin pledge, what can we do right now where we are? How can we bloom where we're planted? Well, we can use devotional books as daily life companions to help us hone our understanding, help us train our imagination and our ability to think in a poetic kind of a way. We can act as best we can in any circumstance, any situation that comes to meet us. We can meditate actively at the beginning of the day, at the end of the day, and periodically through the day as we can, trying to apply the eternal verities to the actions of our lives. And always, always, everywhere, we can detach from the results of actions, act as seems what best we can do, and then practice self-examination. Try to see where we've done the best we can and where we can do far more. And in that service, we can perform a practice that will make perfect by practice, create the skandhas that are needed, help to prepare the substance that we might need in the future to express soul wisdom, and then ultimately just go with the flow. I'm sure you came to the rooms this morning with observations of your own on this particular subject. Yes?
You mentioned that there's a path that one can follow a tough question. With the nature of the devotional books that are available, because each of us as soul are in just the spot where we need to be by karma. We've reincarnated into a body with principles and capacities and limits, and each of the devotional books may speak to each of us in a different way. In fact, it may be that in one time of life, the Gita is the perfect daily companion. And then something happens in life, and maybe it's the light on the path that appeals to us. Or maybe we were raised in a particular religion where there's scripture, Old Testament, New Testament, the Quran, any number of scriptural sources where we begin to read those and say, wait a minute, if I don't read this literally, if I read into it, I can find the philosophy. Sometimes people use something like the Theosophy Simply Stated. Easy to pop into your pocket. And in a time of a little bit of leisure, a little bit of quiet, we can just pull it out and read it if we need. So it would be tough to say which devotional book would best suit any one of us whenever, but they're all available in the reference library, and they're also on the book table in the foyer, and you're more than welcome to look through and see which little pocket companion might be the one that appeals right now. Yes.
And they're also online.
Oh.
You can then just take a quote for yourself for the day or something.
Mm-hmm. Online is great. You know, there is no price that can be placed on theosophical literature, because this is a birthright of all human beings, everywhere and however situated. So there are a couple of the lodges, a few of the lodges have websites where they have links to the literature, and you can print things out as you need them and have them ready for full use. But what you've all been thinking and reading, and this is a really good question that was raised. When you first started looking at devotional books, which ones appealed to you? Sure.
The Bhagavad Gita.
The Gita.
Daily instructions of really how to act, not to create more obstacles for ourselves, and it becomes a daily meditation, because one must be focused on how one reacts and how one thinks,
mm-hmm.
and it becomes a meditation.
The Gita is a meditation thousands of years old. And frankly, it's the backbone, the underlying pin to most modern psychology. And there it is in a very fine form, a judge translation, if you will, that you could just open and read a passage or two and then consider how to use that. There was a hand way in the back.
Well, we ended up finding in the Gita notes, chapter 2, as the most valuable tool for everyday living. It's unbelievable. It's huge. It's bigger than any other chapter, and it's truly wonderful. But we had a question. We have never wanted to be a genius, just a better person.
Mm-hmm. That's a wonderful question. Genius in our modern society has been so defined, I guess I want to say, by artificial intelligence and competition in schools for who can hit every AP course known to man and who's in every honor sections. And looking around the room, long since most of us graduated from high school, with possibly one exception, there are now preparatory works for future teachers that deal with seven avenues of being a genius. that there are seven different expressions to talent in the human kingdom. It's a very different philosophy of what can shine forth. The other thing about genius is many of us think of people who are geniuses who are extremely eccentric or out of touch with reality, with their fellow men. They're almost like appear to be on the spectrum of autism. They're, you know, just not in touch. We think of folks that are really elitist. And those are all images that philosophy would say is personal, transitory, and a perversion of the truth of the true term. So that if we turn our minds to a consideration of the Christ or the Buddha and consider them as a full bloom of genius of what the human being can be, then we're turning our minds back to the previous comment about using the Gita for being the best, kindest, most altruistic, most universal, dynamic force in the life of those around us. How do we serve others? And in that way, that might be something that we would aspire to. Yep, follow up.
Well, just we were thinking, it's enough of a goal to consider yourself the companion of a genius. Mm-hmm. The masters aren't here physically. We can give others what they taught.
We can be a companion. We can study these ideas and attempt to hold them fast during the course of a day. Keep our ears open for an opportunity to use them to assist another in their self-growth. And there's magic to be done. If we are sincere in our motive to be a companion to the masters, however we picture the masters, then every effort we make to remain physically healthy, mentally healthy, spiritually kind, heart-centered, however you want to describe all those things, every time we pick up a devotional book and sincerely read a passage looking for inspiration to lead life in a merry, kind, serviceable way, we are impressing substance. We're sending out vibrations into the metaphysical ranges, but we are also impressing every degree of substance at our avail. And that substance, with value added, is uplifted and therefore is capable of becoming the substance the masters can use. Talk about recycling. It's a pretty good system. Yeah.
We think a phrase that you just used was so spectacular. You said, there's magic to be done.
Oh.
And we're the doers.
Yeah. It is magic. This is pure magic. Yes.
We just thought of maybe 70, 75 years ago when you went to the store to buy milk. You got home, your parents had to shake it up.
Hmm.
Today we don't have to do that. Because everything is evenly distributed throughout that court. You have what is called homogenized milk. So we thought of that in terms of ourselves. And we come up with the word harmony in every department of nature. Would that be an example of the harmony in every department of nature?
Harmony is a great, great word, and this particular student, frankly, is tone deaf, but once in a while can really hear pure harmony and appreciate it. If we can imagine ourselves early in the morning, if we can sit and imagine ourselves using the musical instrument or instruments that are our physical, spiritual, mental makeup, And if we can imagine, if we can take a piece of the Gita or the Voice of the Silence or Light on the Path and just read it for a bit, and then imagine what it would be like to be able to play, to live in and play through our instruments so that we can set a tone and be at one with everything and everyone in existence, every degree of substance. And that imagining, that envisioning, and that holding that picture and then trying to live toward it, we support the harmony. We help to create the harmony. We in energize the harmony potential in the world. And on the other hand, we can use our powers of mind and spirit and heart and really break that harmony down and create a terrible, terrible vibration, a destructive vibration. The choice is ours. Yeah?
And that's a valuable moment, because if you start out with that intention and you fail, you have a wonderful example of where the problem might lie within your personal nature.
Mm-hmm.
So even failure leads to success.
Even failure leads to success. And it's like cleaning out the garage. If you open up the garage door or the closet door and there's everything dripping from everywhere, it's overwhelming. But if you just take one bag or one box or one little container and straighten that out, the task becomes easier and it progressively can be accomplished, and in a very calm and peaceful, nonviolent way. So too with spiritual growth. If we set a goal and have an affirmation, maybe a little phrase that we can repeat to ourselves, and then just gradually, inch by inch, the motive is there, we make the effort to hold it, we practice as best we can, let go of the results of our actions, but continually come back to it. That continuity, that imagination, that will, that desire, focused in that way, will gradually serve all and very gradually produce the basis for what we need to serve others. Yes? Great frowning one?
Well, not really. The frown was just, gee, it sounds like it's, we really have to do this ourselves. That, our tendency is to look outside of ourselves for answers. And you mentioned Mahatmas and great beings, and our world is full of people who are very, very intelligent and seem to have answers to many, many, many questions. And some say that they're enlightened, you how to become enlightened,
mm-hmm.
I mean, it goes on and on and on when we look outside of ourselves for the answer. I think this draws back to the devotional books, because
mm-hmm.
they really, the words that they express aren't outside of us.
Mm-hmm.
They're really, I guess, within us.
Yeah, the devotional books are reminders. In a certain way, the words there evoke an inner comprehension and an intuitive, heartfelt response, if you will. And there are false prophets. Certainly, from the 1960s on, we've been treated to an array of gurus, who for $1.50 will give out all sorts of information. If we judge the activities that we're seeing about us. Someone is a self-styled life coach or master, and our hair on the back of our neck begins to stand up, and our response is, whoa, wait a minute here. Then we've got a reminder that we can look at physical manifestations, but use our soul powers to discern, to find, does this line up with any philosophical points that seem to be eternally true?
is this something that's way off the course and I don't want to have any part of? And again, that if we work with things like the devotional book that turn us inward and allow us to consider and contemplate and then determine the correct right life path for ourselves, we're in good shape. We don't have to wait for a vicarious atonement or forgiveness by another. Is your hand up?
Yes, it is. there's a theory out there, and it's that everybody possesses some sort of genius. And if we consider that we've lived 18 million years in these male
skillions of times we've lived, yeah.
Right. So if we can tap into it through it usually takes like a great teacher, mentor, to really spark that in us and give us the encouragement with the emphasis on courage to bring it out. Don't we all really have some sort of genius, partial at least?
Well, certainly after all these incarnations, as soul, we are living in bodies that are walking memories of part of all those incarnations. But if we're looking for an external source to spark the recall of that, then we may be off base. If we're telling ourselves, you know, if I had just the right teacher, if I had just the right circumstance, then I could come into all these different powers or abilities or talents or whatever it is. The philosophy would say, in terms of the essence of the Buddhic principle, all those memories exist. They are. Everything that we put our minds to, everything that we consider, every sensation that we have, these are vibrations that we've energized to a particular degree and therefore created substance, and those are all available to us. But the process is self-reliance. The beauty of coming together in a meeting like this one is that you have free thinkers, open-minded seekers who are not here to swallow a creed or a dogma or memorize something or in some way get sparked to do something, but rather we come together in a true communion, in a true harmonizing combination, and in such a way we assist each other with enough energy that when we leave the building we can go about our daily lives and recreate within ourselves what it is we need to express. Yeah.
We're thinking that the right book, the right teacher, the right mentor comes along after we have put the demand out in nature. We want to understand, we want to know, and that creates the condition that puts us together with that book or that mentor.
Mm-hmm. And what comes back to mind again about the favorite, the Gita that was mentioned earlier, was that Arjuna in the chariot, in the conversation with Krishna, is an allegory, but we've got to remember that Arjuna had, by self-fulfilled and self-devised efforts, readied himself to be able to have that discourse. And somewhere, I'm not very good at quoting verbatim, but somewhere there's a phrase that if you make yourself ready, the teacher will appear, and I'm probably doing that as a bad translation, but that's the case. We self-ready, like we tune a radio, we tune in as best we can, and then because we're now open and porous, the information will flow. Yeah.
There's all of that points to the fact that there is a chronological order to everything that questioner earlier said that they wanted to be a good person. That is the first step towards being a good person. Desire always comes first, and then everything else follows. So that desire to be a genius, once you understand what a genius is,
mm-hmm.
but that desire has to come first. It's a chronological order to everything that in existence.
There's
not haphazard.
In modern psychology, there's something called a container theory. That the ideas we hold and the words we use to express our self-image becomes a container. And so the soul who comes into this incarnation being taught about original sin and being a lowly sinner will create a particular container, a limit of what expression can be done by that thinker, by that soul. And likewise, as the containers become larger, as we have more concepts and we have a more variety of words with which to express those concepts, we expand our ability to express. The container enlarges until finally the conditioned existence can be literally exploded and released, and therein the Mahatma is born. Yeah.
Well, the statement that you made that the student is ready, the teacher will appear. Well, I think that's how most of us found our way here, that we were looking for an answer,
mm-hmm.
and we found ourselves in these rooms. So the question is, you know, everything that's expressed here is through H.P. Blavatsky, William Q. Judge, Robert Crosby. What is our relationship to these people? Are they our teachers? Or are they enlightened beings? Or how do we view them? Or where do we stand in relationship to them?
Okay, the question is, with the images we have around us, we've got, from where I'm seated right now, I can see Crosby's photograph in the foyer, and of course Judge and Blavatsky right here with us as reminders in this room. The declared purposes of ULT is similarity of the basis of union, the study of the philosophy, and that opening paragraph, the policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy. Each of us as independent thinkers are devoted to the cause of theosophy as an assemblage this morning, the efforts of the room. This particular center of study is independently devoted to the cause of theosophy. Without professing attachment to any theosophical organization, and it is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement. Now, it depends on how you want to take that phrase, and it's for each of us as independent thinkers to determine that. If we are loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, are we envisioning back, you know, light years way back in time, are we imagining ourselves loyal to those elder brothers that helped in the development of this incarnation or manvantara of this global system? Are we loyal to Tsongkhapa, who in 1375 called together the masters existent in the world to determine how might they best assist and support humanity in its effort to seek freedom and truth? Are we loyal to the ones, Blavatsky and Judge, who came into this country in the late 1800s and reestablished the theosophical movement in the form of the old TS
Theosophical Society, and between the two of them managed to get onto paper a wonderful collation of ancient wisdom and inspirational scriptures from across decades, across continents, across all peoples, tied it all up like a bouquet and offered it to not only the folks of the United States, but the folks of the world. Are we loyal to Crosby as the consummate student who would frankly probably be very embarrassed to be called by name this morning? Are we grateful to him? Are we loyal to him because when he saw the need where the Theosophical Society had gone astray from the original straight line literature, he saw the need to come back around and come back to the starting point again and go to the purest statement of the philosophy that he could envision, gathering with him many, many workers to produce United Lodge of Theosophists. So we've got before us exemplars of modern folks who were themselves students, who dedicated themselves to the well-being of all souls in the world, everywhere. We can be loyal to their effort, loyal to their method, and we turn not in devotion to the personalities, but rather we turn to the literature and the philosophy that they brought forth and shared. And then it's up to each of us as individuals to pursue the whole issue of Mahatmas. That's a private study. It's an independent study. On the book table is a little pamphlet on mediatorship, and it was a great help in preparing for this morning because there's a wonderful article on Genius, followed by an even more wonderful article on Mahatmas and Chelas. But these articles can also be found for free online. I think the brochure is 10 cents on, you know, at cost. So, you know, give it some consideration. What does loyalty entail? Is it blind obedience? Is it blind faith? Or is it a devotion to the process of critical thinking, exploration, and open-minded contemplation?
Genius of each other. I mean, one person might have a particular way of seeing something and it never occurred to us. So it sets us off on a journey of educating ourselves. So yes, we are students and teachers of and with mm-hmm. each other.
And look at the assemblage this morning. We are all differing conditions of age and sex and race and backgrounds professionally but we come together in this harmonizing moment where we celebrate the oneness, not the illusion of, you know, there's all these different bodies and entities here, but the potential oneness within us, that with the purity of heart, we can invigorate and set up, like dynamos, set up a motion in the universe that can only help and heal and offer hope to all folks around us. Yes?
So these folks that we just mentioned, mm-hmm. are they the originators of this philosophy?
Oh.
Are they the messengers of it? Or, you know, what how do we view them? Are you know, because there's such a compilation of material and information and knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
What relationship do we have with them?
First of all, not one of them, Blavatsky, Judge, or Crosby, and especially Blavatsky, never once made a claim that any of this philosophy originated with them. Instead, what they did, and in particular her scholarship,
was to go back across time as far back as could be done and pull together written sources in symbolism on tablets, in ancient Sanskrit writing, in cuneiform, and then down through the ages, collated all these ancient teachings from the Neoplatonic school, if you will, from Alexandria, from India, from throughout Asia, North Africa, the Middle East, all these ancient sources, and then pulled them together, almost like you would create a bouquet, and then the string around it was the synthesis, the here it is, this is what this group taught, this is what that master taught, and look at the commonalities. You'll notice that there's a fundamental teaching on this and a fundamental teaching on that. So that what you've got in theosophy today is a combination of pure religion, philosophy, and science in which we are offered ancient teachings for our own perusal, for our own contemplation and discernment, and nothing's original with them. It is said that at the beginning of this particular Manvantara, this period of human expression, that all of this wisdom came into the new circling of life impressed within spirit, and that this impression bubbles up from time to time as it can into the human kingdom when there are minds karmically ready to express it. That's why when the talk began this morning, and all the different popular expressions of genius were mentioned, Mensa, Maslow's hierarchy of needs, super children, child prodigies on TV, IQ, EQ, we all Q, all those different descriptors, if you will, when we, as students, if we study the culture in which we move, we'll see certain underlying premises. And these things are all expressions, maybe partial expressions or poor expressions, of three fundamental propositions. The universality of the source and power of all, the role of cause and effect in life everywhere in all situations, and the perception that there's evolution, there's growth, there's progression, there's a blooming, if you will, of spirit through and in matter. So do we blindly follow teachers? No. We are very well versed that all that we have to read, all these inspirational books, etc., are reflections of universal wisdom across times, across places, and across minds and hearts. Our time is up. Wednesdays, the doors will open at 5:15 for library time, and everything's available to you for personal study. The class itself on the ocean will start at 7:30. See you there.